We are called to order on this 19th day of February, the State Government Finance and Policy Committee. A quorum is present, and we begin this year after the events of June 14th with a new requirement. We will discuss the protocol of the committee, and that is that everyone here must stay seated in the hearing room. There will be no standing or sitting in walkways or aisles. If you need accommodation, please communicate with the sergeant's staff. You will see them in a gold tie. Signs are not permitted in the hearing room or at the testifier's table. We ask you to leave all of those items outside of the room. Clapping and other disruptions are not allowed. Additionally, all testifiers must adhere to a 2-minute time limit so that we can keep the meeting on time and to hear from as many people as possible. Next, I would like to move on to the welcoming of our new member and our staff for the State Government Committee. I would like to introduce Representative Meg Lugar-Nicolay. If you would like to take a moment and say a few words about who you are, welcome.
Hi, I'm Meg Lugar-Nicolay. I'm from House District 64A. I'm coming from only about 4 miles away from here, and I'm really grateful to be joining this body and grateful to be on this committee. So I look forward to working with everyone.
Welcome. We have to my right our new DFL CLA. If you would like to introduce yourself, Anam.
Hello, everyone, and good morning. My name is Anam, and it is a pleasure to be working alongside of you all throughout this session. Thank you.
We have a new DFL researcher. Joe, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Joe Scouten. I'm just really pleased to be here and looking forward to the work we can get done.
Congratulations. We're glad you're with us. And then we have two new pages. Lydia? I don't know where Lydia is. Lydia, would you like to introduce yourself? Welcome. And then we have Amber. And Amber, would you like to say a few words about yourself? All right, welcome. We're excited to have both of the pages with us. The work that the pages do is probably not given as much appreciation as it deserves, and they keep us humming and moving, and we really greatly appreciate them. Next, we would have the approval of the minutes. Co-Chair Nash, would you like to make a motion?
I would move the minutes.
Okay, and those would be the minutes of April 10th. Is there any discussion to the minutes of April 10th? I would like to bring everyone's attention to a letter that we received regarding the minutes and our last conference committee about public discussion on data privacy. So that testimony can happen at another time, but I did want you to know we received a letter just saying that they would like to have a fuller discussion about one of the items that was in the conference committee report. Hearing no discussion about the validity of the minutes, I will ask those in favor of adoption to please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails, and the minutes from April 10th, 2025 are adopted. Next, we will move on to presentations from the Attorney General, followed by Minute, and then the Department of Revenue. If the Attorney General's team will move to the testifying table. Good morning. When you're ready, I will ask you to please introduce yourselves, and then I would ask you to begin your presentation after everyone has been identified. We just want to make sure is the technology all right? One moment while we check technology. Okay. Yay. Awesome. When you're ready, please identify yourself.
Madam Chair, my name is John Keller. I'm the Chief Deputy.
I'm Nick Wonka. I'm the Director of the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit.
Abdulaziz Mohammed, Government Affairs and Public Policy Coordinator.
I welcome all of you to the committee. And when you're ready, if you'll begin your testimony, please.
Chair Claiborne, Chair Nash, members of the committee. I'm Nick Wonka, the Director of Minnesota's Medicaid Fraud Control Unit, which is housed in the Attorney General's office. I'm here today to give you an overview of who we are, what we do, and how we help ensure the state investigates and prosecutes fraudsters who steal taxpayer dollars that should be dedicated to providing critical health care services to Minnesota's most vulnerable people. Minnesota's Medicaid Fraud Control Unit has existed for over 40 years. We're one of 53 in the country. Every state has one, as do D.C., Puerto Rico, and the U.S. Virgin Islands. We're a law enforcement entity in the sense that we investigate and prosecute our own criminal and civil cases. Right now, our budget is for 32 people, and our staff has 7 attorneys, 17 investigators, 2 analysts, 2 paralegals, and 4 support staff, all of whom, as I'll cover shortly, spend 100% of their time working in a single area. Now, each Medicaid fraud unit is funded by a federal grant from the Department of Health and Human Services Office of Inspector General. That grant covers 75% of our funding. All costs, staff salaries, technology, rent, you name it, it's covered. But it comes with conditions on what we can and cannot do. It requires us to spend 100% of our time investigating and prosecuting Medicaid provider fraud and the abuse, neglect, and financial exploitation of vulnerable adults. So specifically, what can we do? We can investigate and prosecute provider fraud, which we have original jurisdiction for under state law. And we can investigate and prosecute certain crimes that come out of provider fraud. Most often, these are money laundering and other financial crimes. We can also do patient abuse and neglect. That often means crimes against vulnerable adults or elderly residents in nursing homes, assisted living facilities, and other similar settings. We don't have original jurisdiction for that, but we can prosecute it upon referral from a county attorney, which in the last 3 months has included financial exploitation charges against an individual in Chippewa County and abuse and neglect charges against a corporate actor and 3 individuals operating an assisted living facility in Anoka County. And finally, we assist federal law enforcement in their investigations. This can include interviews, data analysis, assistance with executing search warrants, and other matters. Our investigators spent most of their time last spring, summer, and early fall doing this, where they worked with the agents from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the FBI performing data analysis and field work. Now, with those federal requirements and federal funding come certain prohibitions, too. We're the investigators and prosecutors, but we aren't the administrators of the program. For example, federal regulations require us to be entirely separate from the agency that administers the Medicaid program, which here in Minnesota is the Department of Human Services. So we can prosecute it, but we can't turn off payments on the front end or bar a certain provider from enrolling with Medicaid or continuing to receive payments. We also cannot investigate or prosecute fraud in obtaining benefits, also known as welfare fraud, or fraud in other public programs like child care assistance or food assistance programs. Now, our work covers all types of provider fraud. These are recent public examples. They include licensed professionals like physical therapists, acupuncturists, chiropractors, mental health therapists, nurses, and other licensees. They also include home health care, from home and community-based services to personal care assistance services, home care nursing services, and adult rehabilitative mental health services. They include non-emergency medical transportation cases, substance abuse treatment provider cases. We've investigated all of these and prosecuted every one that we can prove in a state court. Now, our investigative staff is the bulk of our unit, and they come from a variety of backgrounds. We have a supervisor, auditors, lead investigators, nurse investigators, analysts. We have former FBI agents who specialize in healthcare fraud, former state and local law enforcement with extensive white-collar criminal experience, investigators with financial and banking backgrounds, nurses with healthcare backgrounds, investigators who come from health insurance program integrity units, and a number of ex-military members. And our prosecutors are primarily either former assistant county attorneys or former assistant United States attorneys. Our budget is annually approved by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and as I mentioned, The federal government pays for 75% of our costs, like it does for every Medicaid fraud unit in the country. And each unit size is based on the size of its budget. For instance, California has a much bigger state Medicaid budget than South Dakota, and California has a lot more people in their fraud unit than South Dakota. Our staff size is presently 32, which was set when our state Medicaid budget was $13 billion. Our budget's now over $20 billion, and we still have 32 people. And just looking at us as compared to other states, you'll see how much smaller we are than some with similar budgets. Many of these states have smaller Medicaid budgets than us, yet much larger staff sizes. Some with bigger budgets far exceed us, too. But as I'll detail shortly, that limit hasn't stopped this great group from getting great results. So how do we get our cases? They come in referrals. Most come from DHS or managed care organizations, but we also get them from various law enforcement agencies, other state agencies, and tips from the public. And those referrals have dramatically increased, too. Just looking at pure numbers, as you can see, in 2019, when we went up to 32 people, we had 144 unique referrals that year. We've been well over 200 referrals the past few years, which is an over 40% increase, with no more additional people to take on that work. And the cases we're getting are only more complex. Gone are the days when most of our referrals were on individual home care workers. Now we primarily have referrals on entire agencies, sometimes four or five agencies owned or controlled by a single bad actor, which, as you can imagine, takes many more resources to investigate than a single person. And just to put a finer point on it, we operate on a federal fiscal year, which goes from October 1st to September 30th. And since October 1st of this federal fiscal year, so October 1st of 2025, we've already received over 200 separate referrals. And as of yesterday, the number we've received in just over 4 months exceeds what we've received in any preceding federal fiscal year. So our final totals this year will almost assuredly dwarf anything we've seen in the past. But that size limitation and increase in work hasn't stopped our skilled, dedicated team. The investigators and prosecutors in the division have done great work, as our results show. We regularly exceed other units with many more people in the number of fraud convictions we get. We had the most from 20 to 22 during our last audit period as compared to similarly sized states with staff between 22 and 38. And that has continued since then, as the past few years we've continued to outpace others. For example, as you can see here, we have fewer staff members than other states with similar sized Medicaid spending and a smaller staff. You look at our fraud conviction numbers. They're strong and they continue to be positive. And as you can see elsewhere, last year we ranked 6th in investigations per Medicaid expenditure, 5th in fraud charges, and 8th in fraud convictions in the entire country. And we do not have a top 10 staff size. We're in the middle. And further, just to show the long term, we're on average 5th in fraud convictions in the entire country over the last 6 years. That's a long-running track record of success for the work that our unit does when compared to other states. So that's a brief overview of who we are and what we do and what we've been doing, and I'm happy to answer any additional questions now about the work of this great team that we have. Thank you.
Thank you. Is anyone else going to testify? Okay. All right. I just want to make sure before I go on to member questions. Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just real briefly, when you were talking about the number of referrals so far this year, can you, again, just repeat, you said in 4 months, it's been how many?
Over 200.
Okay. Wow. Okay. Thanks.
Representative Davis, or Vice Chair Davis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Former U.S. Attorney, Assistant U.S. Attorney Joe Thompson, he estimated that there was at least $9 billion worth of Medicaid fraud since 2018, so going back almost 8 years. What would you suggest? Do you have any suggestions for us as a legislature, what we can do to help prevent that?
That is a long question. I think certainly increasing barriers to entry on the front end are something that you'd want to look at. You know, we write, there are, whether it's putting more oversight on providers when they enroll and having more requirements there. There are individually requiring all providers to receive individual provider numbers, NPI numbers, regardless of the type of service they're providing. Some home care workers do that now, not all of them, and particularly in the home and community-based services space, they don't. That is something you're going to want to look at. You're going to want to look at that in ICS too. This is a longer conversation that I'm happy to have with you offline on some of our suggestions, but those are the ones that immediately jump out. And I'll share that with anybody here. You know, we have program recommendations that we can give based on our observations. I will tell you that comes from a fraud prevention perspective, so there's probably a balancing that has to go on with an access to care. But from our perspective as fraud investigators, happy to do that with you offline sometime.
Did you have a follow-up?
Just one quick one.
Yes, Vice Chair Davis.
Thank you for that. And so would you suggest that verifying that businesses are who they say they are, who receive this grant money, would you say that's a good idea? And that's all I have. Thank you.
Yes, please answer.
I think you always want to make sure the people who said that they're owning the business actually are.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I anticipate that some of my questions you'll be offline sending us the information. The first is how many outside lawyers were used, and then a percentage of budget, and then number of attorneys on staff over the last 12 years. And then the next one is, has there been an increase in fraud cases since the OLA stopped doing all of the federally required audits on federally funded programs?
Thank you. And you may answer.
Are you talking about specific to the Medicaid fraud unit or the entire office?
Representative Quam.
I'm not limiting to one area where there's fraud.
Please respond.
I can only answer to the Medicaid fraud unit.
Representative Quam.
Then, you know, if the AG or someone that actually has broad knowledge of your organization can provide the answers, that would be useful. The next is how many investigators investigations were triggered by whistleblowers per year starting with 2018? And then how many were triggered by referrals from the OLA?
Would you like to respond?
I don't have those numbers in front of me, but that's something we can try to provide in the Medicaid fraud context and the ones that came to our unit.
If you have that answer, then if you just send it to C.A. Rudolph, and then it can be circulated to the entire committee. Representative Quam.
Madam Chair, the AG is broader than the one portion that they're talking about, and that's why I want to, having been on the LAC for, 16 years, I am very familiar with multiple times of where they have, especially when they were doing the verifications on some of the programs that were required by the federal government, that there were referrals. And I'm trying to understand how the referral thing has changed over those years, plus what portion of the referrals did they actually do investigations on? And that's not limited to one of the many programs. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Quam. I appreciate the question. Any further discussion for the Attorney General's office? Representative Choi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for this today. You know, I hear you following up on Representative Davis' question is you can speak offline and give us some information that would help curb the fraud, some of this stuff. I don't know how long you've been here, but I don't know. Have you had past conversations on, like, checks and balances, things we could have checked, things we could be doing? I know now you're saying you can give us a list. Has there been previous conversations with that, or has there ever been, like, hey, just to let you guys know, these are some things the legislator could enact to make fraud a little less preventable. Is there any of that? That's just my question. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Choi. Do you have a response?
Are you speaking with our conversations with legislators or with other people? Just to clarify the question.
Okay. Representative Joy, would you like to clarify?
With the legislators and other people, if you've had, you know, 5 years ago, had conversations with other people like, hey, these are some things that could be done to prevent fraud. Have we noticed this instead of just recently when I have a conversation, or have we noticed this in the past?
Thank you, Representative Joy. And I just want to remind the body that we did ask them to come in specifically to speak about the Medicaid Fraud Division. So that's on us for asking them to speak to this particular topic. Do you have a response?
We've never been asked by any legislators to give those type of program recommendations. We would be happy to have those conversations with you. We do have conversations with DHS people about those type of issues, and we have made recommendations there.
And Representative Joy, I will say, while you and I have never spoken, I know that I have had conversations with the AG's office regarding prevention measures related to fraud. So there are conversations between the AG's office and legislators who are interested in this work. So I just, but I realize you and I have never spoken. I don't think we've met before today. So thank you for being with us. Did you have any further follow-up?
No, it's just enlightening to me, Madam Chair, and to your staff and you guys, that we're willing to take those steps and get this done. And you know what? I hope the legislator takes it serious and we come and take your guys' input and move some stuff with that, because, you know, we're all here to be good stewards of taxpayer money. And so I really hope we do that, and I look forward to being involved in those communications too. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Joy. And I would like to say that Representative Nash and I have worked very closely to make sure that the Medicaid Fraud Unit got funded from the House. So Representative Nash, or Chair Nash, would you like to say something?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I was going to hearken back to your statement about the House being the better body, and you might want to run that by Representative Freiberg, who's about to make an interesting decision. But we did talk very heavily about funding the Medicaid fraud. The Senate, in their lack of infinite wisdom, decided that that was not something that they wanted to do. But what I will also say is that any time that I've ever asked for a meeting, or we've asked for a meeting, the AG's office has been more than happy to come by and maybe lay out some things that we could do. And I think that that would be really good for all of us as we talk about fraud on a daily basis, to see what is it that we can glean from them or the OLA or whomever that we want to talk to, and try to transport that into a policy directive. So I know that they would be more than happy to stop by and meet with all of us, and perhaps we could have them come to one of our huddles or whatever, but they're very available for us to talk to, and I think that what they've learned are some things that we could put into policy action.
Thank you, Chair Nash. And I'm sorry, Representative Kraft, I missed you. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Want to go back to the referrals over the past 4 months. In your presentation, you talked about how they come from many different places. You know, this number, where are they coming from? Where is something changed? Yeah, give a little more color on where those referrals are coming from.
They're primarily coming from DHS and managed care organizations. I think they're trying to do much quicker investigations now, and they are sending them to us at the first sign of a credible allegation of fraud, which they are required to do. That's probably the best answer I can give for you in this type of setting.
Thank you very much. And I think we'll move on. So I thank you so much for your willingness to be with us today and to talk about your fraud unit. I appreciate the work that you do, and you do really great work. And I think Minnesota can be proud of the fact that we're fifth in the nation on the work that you do. So thank you so much. Next, we will have the Department of Minnesota IT come forward. Commissioner, I thought I saw you here. Welcome, Commissioner Tomes, and I'm going to ask if you will introduce the staff that you brought with you today, and then proceed with your testimony, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have with me today Deputy Commissioner John Eichten and our Director of Legislative Affairs, Brandon Hirsch. Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. For the record, my name is Tarek Tomes, and I serve as the Commissioner of Minnesota IT Services and the state's Chief Information Officer. This committee has been integral in advancing modernization efforts across many state programs and services, and that advice, direction, investment, guidance is instrumental in Minnesota's efforts to combat fraud. I would like to take a few minutes to update the committee on the progress we've made effectively utilizing those advancements, and then turn it over to Deputy Commissioner John Eichten to share more specific work on the state's modern identity and access solution that was built with a portion of the investments provided by this committee. Program integrity requires strategic investment in secure and modern technology. Across the globe, fraud actors have really accelerated their efforts against organizations, whether private sector or public sector. I think fraud globally is up 30 to 40% over the last years, and we certainly see investments totaling billions of dollars in private sector organizations in putting modern technology capabilities to help combat fraud, including organizations here, Fortune 100 retail organizations in the Twin Cities that have significantly increased their investment related to the increases in fraud they see and the increases in the capabilities that they need to continue to evolve. In 2023, the legislature invested $33 million in MINIT to advance the governor's vision of stronger cybersecurity across Minnesota. Those investments have supported launching Minnesota's whole-of-state cybersecurity grant program supported by federal funding in the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act. As we noted in October, a $5 million state investment in this program has helped avoid well over $300 million in potential cybersecurity impacts for local governments and school districts across Minnesota. Over the last 12 months alone, over 220 million events detected that triggered over 650,000 automated investigations. Of the millions of threats detected, over 107,000 over the last 12 months had potential for impact that is really significant. In general, the average impact of a significant cybersecurity event, generally about $2.8 million, as we saw recently, a large city in Minnesota, in St. Paul. I think we can quickly get to, you know, that level of impact. And that impact doesn't count the impact on people relying on services. You know, that is the impact just for the response. And so that $5 million investment that was provided by this body and supported by this body, well over $300 million in savings. So I think it really demonstrates such a profound impact made by that investment. Minnesota's Security Operations Center Modernization Program. This program strengthens MINIT's Security Operations Center and provides our teams with modern tools to identify and stop cyber threats before they impact service availability or compromise Minnesotans' data. These investments also modernized LogInMN, the state's identity validation and verification service, allowing programs to onboard more quickly and strengthening protections for critical services. That LogInMN service is the identity verification mechanism that's also used for the recently launched paid family medical leave program. We'll dive deeper on LogInMN in a few minutes. And finally, the 2023 investments supported the one-time purchase of capabilities that enhance the baseline security of MNET, the Minnesota backbone network that exists in all counties, many tribal nations, is leveraged by local forms of government to great effect. Next, the cloud transformation. $33.5 million invested in cloud transformation. These investments rapidly modernize infrastructure to enhance resilience, scalability, and continuity of service. We accelerated cloud planning and migration across executive branch agencies and have moved well over 3,700 servers and over 500 applications into the cloud, a major milestone in modernizing Minnesota's technology foundation.
By shifting the workloads into secure, scalable cloud environments, we improved resilience and system performance while reducing dependency on aging on-premises infrastructure. Cloud adoption strengthens business continuity by enabling agencies to maintain operations during outages, cyber incidents, or surge events. Through CloudRamp-enabled acceleration, we position state systems to capture future cost savings, drive innovation, and increase agility, strengthening long-term service delivery. These achievements support Minute's strategic objective of maturing operations and delivering consistently efficient services across state government. This was about much, much more than moving technology. It was about strengthening Minnesota's digital backbone for the next generation of service delivery, and I really appreciate this body's support and guidance as it relates to that. Lastly, the Technology Modernization Fund, a $40 million investment, and Chair Cleavorn and Representative Nash, you know, we had so many conversations about this, and I could not be more appreciative of your advice and guidance and support of that vehicle. In my tenure as the CIO, it has been the most profound, impactful way to shift and meet today's needs in a timely manner that I have seen in state government. Funding directly improved customer experience and reduced cybersecurity risk in systems Minnesota rely on every day. New Technology Modernization Fund investments expanded Minnesota's ability to modernize high-impact systems and improve digital experiences for Minnesotans. To date, the Modernization Steering Team has approved 67 requests across 28 agencies and authorized $31.8 million of the $40 million Technology Modernization Fund. Technology modernization supports modernizations of high-impact systems, such as agency licensing platforms, regulatory compliance tools, enterprise identity services, improving reliability while reducing cybersecurity and risk. Modernization funding directly helps shift state systems towards standardized, secure platforms, reducing technical debt and cybersecurity risk while improving reliability and user satisfaction and making government operations run much, much more efficiently. These efforts align with Minute's far-reaching digital strategy to improve access, equity, and efficiency for all Minnesotans. With the Technology Modernization Fund, we're updating what matters most so Minnesotans get secure, easier-to-use services, and agencies can operate more sustainably and efficiently. My sincere thanks to the legislature for your support and partnership as we've worked together to deliver meaningful impact with these investments. Madam Chair, with that, I'd like to turn the presentation over to Deputy Commissioner John Eichen to share a little bit more information about logging them in.
Okay, before we do that, again, a moment of personal privilege. Commissioner Tomes, I began chairing this committee in 2023. And before taking the gavel, I asked Speaker Hortman, if we could please have investments in our IT infrastructure. And I said, unless you agree to allow us to use the money to invest in our infrastructure, I'm not interested in the gavel because the work is so important and our systems were so old. And I want to thank you for your service to the state of Minnesota. I don't know if you want to say anything about that today, but your work and your guidance, your tutelage, your mentorship for me as a novice in IT was really critical to my growth and development. So I just want to thank you for your service to all of us in the state, but I also want to just thank you for your tremendous mentorship for me when it comes to what happens behind the scenes and when someone clicks a button. So I really appreciate that. Chair Nash.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I'll echo what my co-chair said. Commissioner, as you remember, you and I were asked to apply for the same job by the governor when he first took office. I giggled a little bit, but I will say that the better man got the job. You've been great to work with. And, you know, one of the things that you and I both agree on is that ones and zeros are neither Republican or Democrat, and that we owe to the state, the people who live here, the people who interact with the state, a good infrastructure. When you took over, we didn't really have a great infrastructure. We had a lot of aging technology. We had a lot, as we call in the IT world, iron on the floor. We had, I think, 77 data centers that needed to be pared down. I think we're at 3 now, which utilizes some best practices. But, you know, you've been great to work with. When I did the Cloud First bill, we worked together to make sure that that was sort of the jumping off point to our modernization and utilization of cloud technology, which saves the state money, increases security, increases speed and delivery of what it is that we're trying to get out the door. But I wanted to thank you most of all for the project that we worked on last year. We together fixed or got the ball rolling on fixing SSIS. And I wanted to say that I appreciate very much that you came to meet with me. I had been given direction by Chair Torkelson, here we're going to find some money. Nash, it's your job to make sure that we don't mess this up. And you and I together sort of set things in motion and then wound up with a really good end result, because SSIS, as it sits today, is antiquated green screen technology run on AS400s, and it is not what's needed for our state. And I just think that you've done a really solid job of making sure that Minute is left in a better condition than when you first took over. So as you head off to your next adventure, wanted to just say thank you.
Thank you.
And one more moment. Vice Chair Bonner.
Thank you for that. I'll try to be brief, but I just wanted to say also a debt of gratitude. I've said this before as the chair of the Cybersecurity Commission, a member of the Governor's Technical Advisory Council, which is sort of a public-private agency collaboration of how we make good government that actually serves real people. And under your tutelage, we have created a culture of innovation, and it shows. While most people, we talk about these archaic dinosaurs of technology that we have, the reality is Minnesota is leading the country in doing this work, and a good part of that is due to your tutelage. And so I'm so grateful for that. Meeting people where they are is what each of us in this room does. And with the modernization funds, which is a little like a shark tank of sorts, where folks come in with the best of the best projects and we review them and then fund them as appropriate. That has made a massive difference. And we've seen some really incredible things come out of that program. The work of putting in $5 million to save $300 million and thwart attacks on the cybersecurity front, working to put in cybersecurity reporting requirements. And of course, now I would be remiss if I did not mention we also have a cybersecurity grant program that will likely come before this committee. But I just want to say thank you for all of those investments. Minnesotans are better off for it. Their lives are a little bit better for it. And we so appreciate your work, and we look forward to seeing that culture continue under Deputy Commissioner Eitan.
Thank you very much. And with that, we will transition to you, Deputy Commissioner.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members, and apologies to the Commissioner. I know hearing that much praise was difficult for him to endure. I echo and wholeheartedly agree. I was asked to come here today, or we were asked to touch a bit on Login MN, just to provide a backdrop. Wanted in our first slide here to just talk about the relationship between cybersecurity defenses and fraud defenses. So these are, while cyber, as you know, Minute partners with agencies across the executive branch. All executive branch entities, we are their internal IT department. And so we work with them to implement proactive measures to try and reduce risk, not only through strong cybersecurity, but also through defensive tactics on the fraud side of the house. Of course, cybersecurity focuses on safeguarding networks, safeguarding applications and systems and data from unauthorized attacks, breaches, Fraud defenses focuses on preventing those deceptive practices that take advantage not just of the technology, but also the business processes in place, the policies that are in place, and frankly, human nature to engage in deceptive practices and steal resources. So while these are distinct, fraud and cyber, they overlap in significant ways. And in terms of shared goals, they both seek to protect assets, to protect data. There's complementary controls in both sides of the house, and there are overlapping threat vectors. Just moving to the next slide here, one of those, so with that backdrop, the primary purpose, as I said, of the presentation today is to talk about one of those overlapping threat vectors, which is namely identity theft and impersonation via the implementation, as the commissioner mentioned, of a modern identity access management solution with robust identity proofing for use by state agencies who engage with residents, counties, external partners as well. The goals of a Login MN are really twofold. One, to improve customer experience. This is a new front door to all public-facing state digital services that residents go online to access and apply for. But it's also to strengthen security. As I said, improve fraud detection with tools like multi-factor authentication, and then three levels of identity proofing to protect users' private information, help prevent fraud. And really, the agencies have the ability to set the appropriate level of that identity proofing given the risk of the program. So just to dive a little bit deeper on that, as I said, a new front door, which provides a single credential for a seamless experience for Minnesota residents. So they don't need to maintain multiple passwords if they are a customer of MnSure, if they are needing to access unemployment insurance benefits, if they are a licensee of a particular occupational board. But it also improves fraud detection. So as I mentioned, with those three levels of identity proofing, if you think we don't need the same level of identity proofing for someone who's coming to the DNR website to buy from the DNR nurseries, right, to buy saplings, we need a much higher level for a program like paid family medical leave. So paid family medical leave is leveraging the highest level of identity proofing. So what that requires is not only that someone have essentially a device that helps to identify who they are, but that they are actually providing a picture of a photo ID, as well as taking a selfie with their camera as a liveness check to ensure that AI tools and other impersonation tactics are not successfully allowing them to impersonate another individual and fraudulently access benefits or services. So that is live right now. We are seeing every day individuals pass through that process. Of course, not everyone has the same level of technological ability. So there's a customer service element to this of assisting people through the process. But I can reference the one other program where this was leveraged and was leveraged successfully was the Frontline Worker Program. Slightly different tool, but the same level of identity proofing, which really provides a foundation for fraud detection and fraud defense. So with that, I know your committee has some other work ahead of it, but really this, what Login MN is about in a nutshell, is ensuring, verifying that a person is who they say they are when they come to us online, and before we grant access to any applications, restricted data, and allow them to apply for a benefit or a service. It's live right now. I encourage you, if you get your phone, login.mn.gov. You can create an account, even if you're not using a particular service. You wouldn't experience the ID selfie level of validation until you go to apply for a program that actually requires that level. But we will be working with agencies across the state over the months and years to come to roll this out. We're focused on some of the major DHS, DCYF program areas in the very near term who are leveraging our legacy solution. So we'll be moving them onto the more modern Login MN solution and then working with other public-facing online services across the state to accelerate the adoption of this service. And this is something that we're talking a lot about in the OIG Coordinating Council and the interagency fraud working groups that were created via the governor's executive order, that this is can be a significant tool in the toolbox to help fight fraud. So thank you, Madam Chair, members. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you so much, and we're really glad that you're here, and we're really glad that, you know, the cybersecurity piece and the identity is really important, but it also the one-stop ability for the individuals who need to use these systems is really very helpful. So thank you. Members, do you have any questions? We're going to wrap this up pretty soon, but any discussion? Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And how extensive is the facial rec utilization, and are you tied into any national databases to catch so?
Deputy Commissioner.
Madam Chair, I want to, and Representative Kwan, want to distinguish the selfie is not facial recognition in the sense of trying to tie that image to an existing record or data that exists in some state or federal level database. It is really a liveness check to ensure that the person who is submitting both the submitting that identification is a living human being and not a deep fake or something that was created via an AI tool.
It's similar to the receptionist checking our ID when we go to the doctor's office, right?
Absolutely. Or if you've interacted with IRS.gov, if you've created an IRS.gov account, they use the ID.me service. It's the same type of service of a photo ID and a selfie.
Representative Kwan, one follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Arizona uses the facial rec and have caught, example, a few years ago, a Minnesota person who was guilty of transporting minors across state lines and had multiple IDs. And that's why I was, when you pick up, it's not, I like that extended part of it. And then offline, I'm interested in the data of how much funds does Minute get directly from the different agencies and departments? And what percentage of your budget that is, and then what is the percentage of staff that are embedded in those different agencies and departments? Then how many different operating systems are still being utilized across state government? And it was brought up that you're down to only three data centers. The size varies, and I thought that Department of Revenue was somewhat reluctant in past years and had a pretty, so they are included, good. And then what is the percent of internal versus external for server farms, server pods?
Representative Kwan, so you've asked a lot of questions, and in my naivete, I'm not exactly sure all the things you're asking, so I would ask of you please to put this into an email form. Send it to either Co-Chair Nash or myself, and then we will ask for all these answers, just so we're sure and we have a record of what you've asked for. I would appreciate that.
Madam Chair, I thought our meetings were recorded, and if there are questions, I can interact with them so they understand what I'm looking for, but they're actually here, and that's why I ask questions, so that they can answer questions, and people watching can understand that we're actually doing the due diligence of the legislation, part of our job of understanding the breakdown in detail.
I have no problem with the questions you're asking. What I'm saying to you is I want to make sure that we give them the full consideration that they deserve, and that we would do that. If you would please, I'm happy to circulate it to the committee. It's just a lot of information, and we still have more work to do today. So,
right, and that's why I asked, Madam Chair, offline. But
perfect.
A direct conversation would be more useful, clarity-wise, and streamline any, miscommunication. Direct communication is much better than communicating with somebody who communicates, etc. But thank you, Madam Chair.
Co-Chair Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll work with Representative Kwan, and we'll make sure we get questions because there were some good. Content there. So to either the commissioner or the deputy commissioner, you know, one of the things that we'd like to measure as a success rate is who did you filter out or what did you filter out? And maybe give a little highlight as to the login and what you've been able to prevent from getting into that, because that's always a very interesting metric as well as to what were your defenses able to filter out before they got too far.
I can take that.
Thank you so much for your presentation. Would you like to answer that before we?
Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative Nash, and we can follow up in more detail. There are quite a few really significant and relevant examples already where the identity verification defenses, in particular tied to paid family medical leave, have really thwarted attempted fraud attempts, where the front end of detecting the attempted creation of multiple identities from the same device automatically triggered investigative recourse by the paid family medical leave team, where the potential submission of multiple applications actually became a complete non-event. And so we see, you know, these ties, and what will continue to be important is continued evolution and investment of these defenses as threat actors and threat mechanisms will continue to change. And, you know, the incarnation that we see currently of LoginMN can't be the incarnation of LoginMN that we see 12 months from now or 18 months from now. Like, we have to understand that we have to continually invest in these critical digital capabilities as critical infrastructure. And this body has been absolutely just exceptional as it relates to the guidance and support of investing in these types of capabilities that continually need to evolve.
Thank you, Co-Chair Nash.
And thank you, Madam Chair. And I'll look for that report from Mr. Eichten, since your reporting days are limited right now. I think today is the last day. Is that right?
Madam Chair, Representative Nash, March 6th.
Okay. Maybe you can write that for us.
So I can still write that.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Since I wasn't going to mention your departure, is there anything that you would like to say about that?
Madam Chair, you know, and definitely don't have anything, you know, prepared to say. I would say the last 7 years, almost 7 years in this role, I've really found extraordinary. I've had the privilege of working with exceptional, extraordinary people through difficult times, from fixing a driver and vehicle services system to, you know, COVID, to remote work, to bringing workforce back, to the modernization of so many different things. And I've loved every second of this work. I've loved every second of working together with the legislature, with my commissioner peers in what really is an amazing cabinet. The work that we do together with the Technology Advisory Committee. I think this role, the CIO role in the state of Minnesota, is really probably the envy of the country, because I've never felt a partisan nature to the work that we do, whether it's rallying together to support the modernization of the child welfare information system, and working together with counties and tribal nations on shaping a better way to interact with services related to the human services space. It has just been an honor and a privilege every day in this role, and I'll continue to be as big a supporter as I possibly can be. I really hope that this body and certainly the my peers across the cabinet, that we have the highest of expectations of the impact and results that technology can deliver. Like, I just hope we never settle, that we never accept you know, anything short of what the highest of expectations are. When we have a system that's old, it's because we choose to have a system that's old. It is our collective choice between the executive branch and the legislature to prioritize and invest. And we saw that in the child welfare information system. That's going to really change outcomes for over 200,000 children that are in the child welfare system. I mean, those are such profound impacts. And to have some small role in being able to find nutrition benefits for children, or connect people with health care, or connect people with paid family medical leaves is something that we'll always cherish. Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you. And again, please accept our deepest debt of gratitude. We appreciate the work that you've done, and we look forward to our continued work, however that may be in the future.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. I appreciate your presentation today. Next, we have the Department of Revenue. And I'd like to ask anyone who has their phone on, would you please silence your phone? And if you need to have a phone conversation, please take it outside of the room. Thank you. Commissioner Marquardt, so good to have you back with us. If you are ready, if you'll introduce your team and then begin your testimony, please.
Well, thank you very much, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Paul Marquardt. I'm the Commissioner of Revenue. I'm joined here by Devin Armstrong, our legislative coordinator. And Madam Chair and members, what I'd like to do is talk about the Department of Revenue's efforts in voluntary compliance and compliance enforcement, and then also stopping fraud.
Okay, but we're not talking about your budget today. I'm just
Madam
setting
Chair,
that expectation for the committee.
No okay. budget today. So, if we can move. Yep. So, Madam Chair, I usually don't spend a lot of time on the mission, vision, and values, even though that's really important, but that second one there, the vision, is what really guides the Department of Revenue. And I will tell you, this is through Democratic administrations, Republican administration, independent administration, doesn't matter in the Department of Revenue. The thing is that folks should pay no more or no less as required by law. And that really guides the Department of Revenue's culture and the efforts that we're going to talk about today. So the four main areas we're going to look at is voluntary compliance, and then its education efforts, the enforcement, and then fraud prevention, and then actually stopping fraud once something might get into the system. So that's what we're going to talk about today. The first area is voluntary compliance, and that's kind of always misunderstood because people say, paying my taxes isn't voluntary, I have to. That's true. So you're required by law to pay your taxes, but the system relies on taxpayers to file accurate and honest tax returns. And so that's the voluntary compliance part. And so as you move forward, you're going to see how a lot of different actors are really important in all of this. And the state of Minnesota, we have about 97% to 98% compliance. And so with that 97%, 98%, the key is to make sure those who are paying pay no more, no less required by law, and then to find those other 2% to 3% also. So a big key are the stakeholders in this system. So it's individuals, businesses, all of those who are required to pay those taxes, but also the tax services, your accountants and your vendors and all these other folks who play a big part. So it takes a lot of people to file a tax return. I think that's what's really important here. So another really important area of voluntary compliance is education. That's why we are always here in the department when folks come up with bills and so forth, is how can we keep the tax code simple and transparent? Because if we're going to get voluntary compliance, we can't make it difficult for people to do that. So we spend a lot of time at the Department of Revenue providing education in a lot of different ways, and I'm not going to read all those, but you can see, and you know, we're always out at the state fair, up by the education building, and there's got a little spinning wheel. You can ask a question and get a Smartie or some little candy, so never hesitate to stop by. Another area is also, and this is key, is that if I am a taxpayer, I expect my information to be confidential, to be secure, to be private, to be privileged, and it should only be used for tax purposes. And so within the department, we do a lot to make sure that 1,400 employees aren't what we call browsing, which means going into Representative Joy's tax filing without a proper reason to do so. And that is serious, and you know, termination is evident in those type of situations. So we've got a lot of protections within our system to make sure that the integrity of your tax return is kept very private. Now, I will say that brings up concerns when you hear that the IRS, for example, there's just recently they shared inappropriately some information with Homeland Security. And that can have a real chilling impact on people who, I don't want my information to go elsewhere. And so that's always a concern too. So just like with our department in sharing information, and we do, but we're very careful when we share that information that it can only be for tax information, and it's only information that we're allowed to do. So how do we enforce compliance enforcement? Again, we rely on the security and integrity of a system that we have. The folks at the Department of Revenue, we have many who have gone through this certified fraud examiner's training. And this is 32 hours of training, 4 days. There's 4 exams. And it really focuses on identifying potential fraud and compliance throughout the system. And we are constantly improving that process. We also have in place a lot of, you know, our FAST or our Gentax, which is our software that generates things. And they are also constantly looking for red flags and things that might not look right. Next area, please. So collections. A big part of that is our collections division, and is that looking at inadvertent errors. There's unintentional mistakes. You know, we have early audits when a filing comes through that someone might have transposed a number, or they might not have signed it, or their address might not be correct, or other things like that that we can just correct right away because the system catches that. There's also, you know, civil enforcement on past due taxes, identifying non-filers, getting them to file, including those who haven't filed their returns. So our collection division does an awful lot of that, and it can include a forced filing, which means that is a commissioner's filing. So if we know that you've got information on W-2 or 1099, but you haven't filed, we send you a letter, you have 30 days, and if you don't reply with the information that we have, it's called a commissioner's filing, we will file those taxes and collect those payments at that point. Also, if people really do have huge financial burdens, we can set up payment plans, or there's some cases where we can actually suspend that, depending on what type of a hardship or a case there might be. So that's rare, but that can go through that, and also through audits. What are the numbers? If you look at this, so through collections, through audits, here are the dollars. And just focus on 2025 and go to the right. The total between that is about $562 million in 2025. So those are dollars that would not be collected but for the efforts of the Department of Revenue and going through its systems. And also, if you notice on other agency debt, we collect debt for cities and counties and universities and other type of debt too. And that's a smaller number, but part of that $562 million that's there. Next area is also when it gets serious. And that is, you know, someone's keeping 2 sets of books, they are willful evasion, all these type of things. That then goes to our criminal investigation division. And so we get referrals from the Department of Revenue. They'll catch something and see something. They'll send it to the criminal division, referrals from other federal and state agencies. And also we get tips from the public that we follow through on also. So we enforce those statutes 289A and so forth, which is willful evasion, that's a felony, false and fraudulent returns, that's a felony, and so we can go through those areas. All right, so we will move to the next one. Here's the numbers on that. Last year, 36 cases were charged out. $1.9 million. And if you want to see those cases, you can go to our website on Newsroom, and we have those cases that are there. But also, I should have said, Madam Chair, that if you have any real detailed questions, I do have folks from revenue here to answer questions too. So stopping fraud. So types of tax fraud, several of those. There is taxpayer misuse of taxes collected on behalf of the state. So that might be a business that's supposed to collect sales tax. And I want to mention one area here is that, and in the Department of Revenue in our criminal division was a leader, national leader in this, is that in 2017, the legislature passed the anti-zapper law. And a zapper is a software device like a thumb drive that businesses could put into their kind of computer system, and it suppresses certain sales. It looks like when you look at the books, everything's right, but it takes out a sale every once in a while. And in 2018, we made our first conviction. And in fact, in 2018, we actually, and Melanie Leslie is here, the head of our division, went out to New York and did the search warrant on the person who actually developed the software called Happy World, and charged him there, and they did the search warrant at like 4 a.m. in the morning. But this was huge, and it stops millions and millions of dollars of fraud, but it was kind of an interesting case that we were really a leader on. If we can move to the next one, stopping tax fraud. So, you know, before filing, if you can do it, after filing, and I'm going to get into an example here, and then ongoing voluntary compliance and compliance enforcement. So if we can move to the next one, please. Thank you. Tax fraud is, you know, something that's done every single day. The important thing here, I think, which is new, is Governor Walz's Executive Order 2510 requires all agencies to report potential tax fraud to us. And I think you heard from the Medicaid area, from the Attorney General office too. But just in the last 2 weeks, we've received 60 referrals from other agencies of the state to look at. And then program fraud is different than tax fraud, of course. So we also have done that. So if we're into tax fraud and it leads to something else, it goes into a program fraud. I'm saying we're looking at tax fraud first, certainly, but it can now go into those other areas. And it also, the executive order prioritizes sharing information. So there is more. There isn't these silos anymore among all these departments. The executive order 2510 and work of the legislature and the OLA has us also sharing information that we can do. Just some of the things that are more specific to revenue based on the governor's Walz's executive order is just improved effectiveness of looking at risk management just in everything and looking at all of our actions on audits and everything like that. Also, instructing all employees on program fraud because we're at the Department of Revenue really good at catching tax fraud, and now it's getting, even though we were doing that before, having all employees looking at where that could be. And I think the last bullet there is just consistency, making sure that we have consistency on how we're handling fraud, how we're looking at program fraud and all of those things into the future. Okay, so the next slide here is what are the numbers? In the last 4 years, we have validated stopping $270 million in fraud. And that is mainly through where folks are wanting to get a refund. Now, these are primarily folks who have stolen someone else's ID or have some other IP number that it's tough to track and so forth. But if we can go to the next slide, it kind of shows the system and how, in fact, if it wasn't for the work of Department of Revenue, these dollars would have gone out. So if you look on the left on the blue there, they've gotten into the system because they have either used someone else's ID or some other illegal way. And how we stop that is often is that we have our own system in the Department of Revenue. And I'm not going to get into details because, quite frankly, I don't know the indicators. They won't tell me what the indicators are that would indicate a red flag. But there's a number of things they look for. you know, make sure the identity is correct, IP addresses, all these type of things. And so the Department of Revenue, we do that, and if things come up, we give it a risk score. We also have our FAST, which is our software, and there's a system called FIVES, and it stands for Fast Identity Verification System. They are also doing the same thing. So you have kind of two systems looking at, and if that risk score is over a certain number or whatever, they say, you know what, this is really risky to move forward, and we'll stop it at that point. And then we also have folks actually literally looking at things. And so what we will do, and this is one example that actually affected a revenue employee, is that it was somebody that looked suspicious, so we called that person and said, did you file a property homeowner's property tax? Well, no, we haven't. Well, someone did. And so we follow up. But that is, they have gotten into the system, and if it wasn't for the system stopping it, it would $270 million would have gone out in the last 4 years. And so the last one, last two slides here, stopping fraud here, other ways, stolen checks and so forth. There's ways we can find that out. We work, you know, there's been tax preparers who have been, there's been fraud there that we've been able to stop there. The last one, revenue blocks approximately 20 million attempted cyber attacks. Again, congratulations to Commissioner Tomes for their efforts at Minute to do that. And, you know, we've got bad folks out there, bad people out there trying to rip off Minnesota every day, and we've got to stop that. And, you know, this is another way they try to do that. So the final slide, Madam Chair, is this one, just kind of putting it all together, is that actually in the last 4 years, the Department of Revenue and the excellent work by those employees have either brought in or prevented $2.26 billion, and that's verified. We've got those numbers, which is about $550 million a year that we have saved or protected tax dollars. And I will say, and thank you, is the work of the legislature and the OLA and the governor's executive orders have all helped us in doing that. So open for questions, and thank you so much.
Thank you very much for your testimony. It's really great, and I appreciate the great work you and your team do for our state. Member questions? Did you have a Vice Chair Bonner.
I'll be very, very, very brief. I just wanted to say thank you for all of your work on these tools, and I know that some of the technology tools that we've been employing at folks like the Department of Revenue really do matter. For example, you talked about an individual tax return getting flagged. I had lunch with a legislator just the other day who said, in fact, she got a notification that her information had been used and that flagged, and so she was trying to sort out how to address that issue specifically. But I do think we continue to see that investments in the technology and the tools really are helping prevent fraud, and they really are helping save taxpayer dollars. So I just want to say thank you for your part in that effort.
Thank you.
Representative Kosnick.
Thank you. Commissioner, good to see you. I appreciate the numbers that you threw out there in terms of what fraud was prevented. How many actual convictions of fraud came from work done at Minnesota Revenue?
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Representative Kosnick, you're talking, for example, that $270 million or which? So the on the collection part, a lot of that is civil. So that's, you know, people who owe, we collect, and there's probably going to be a civil penalty, which would be, you know, if you owe $1,000, you might have $500 in penalties and interest and so forth. On those that I was describing that kind of came into the system, we don't know. Some of those might be those that the criminal division are prosecuting too. But the problem with that, and I've talked a lot with staff at Revenue, is these are folks that got, they're stealing someone else's identification, and there's really no way to kind of grab onto who these folks are. So those of that, let's say $270 million, I would say not many of those would be prosecuted unless they were folks that we prosecuted later for something else, because it's just really difficult because of the way they're getting into our system. I don't know if that answers your question.
Representative Klassen.
Yeah, thank you for the follow-up. Yeah, I guess I appreciate the work, and it's necessary, and that's what one of the mechanisms that we're responsible for. But I guess if you want to ask somebody, I'm curious, like, how many people have we actually prosecuted then? I get the civil if someone misfiling on their report or trying to be evasive, but actual the criminal side, do you have a number of how many people were actually convicted and charged? Or you're saying because it's electronic and stuff, we didn't get anybody?
Yeah, I'll have Melanie Leslie, director of our criminal investigation unit.
If you would please state your name for the record before you answer the question, please. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair and committee, thank you. My name is Melanie Leslie. I am the director of the Criminal Investigation Division at Department of Revenue. I believe it was slide 14, if we could go back in the presentation, that had the statistics for my division. So right there, the chart shows from 2022 through 2025 the number of cases that my unit has criminally charged. So I believe that answers your question, unless you had any specific questions about those numbers.
Madam Chair, thank you. I put the glare on there. I didn't see it on the screen, but it's getting there. But I guess for the these aren't that large of numbers of people being convicted for the size of dollars, I guess. But I hope we can continue to do that and appreciate the work. And I think we have a lot more work to do because we can't just allow people to break into systems and then not track them down. So I hope we get better at that and have some consequences for people trying to do this.
Thank you, Representative Kosnick. And Ms. Leslie, I have a question for you. So it is my understanding that some of this fraud is out of the PPP program. So you would have high dollars with low numbers, is that correct or not?
My unit does not investigate PPP fraud.
Okay, so then maybe Commissioner, what has happened with PPP fraud?
So Madam Chair, members of the committee, according to the U.S. Small Business Administration Office of Inspector General, between the Paycheck Protection Program and the economic injury disaster loans, about $1.2 trillion went out, and they estimated that potentially $200 billion of potential fraud went out on those programs. So in Minnesota, our connection to that back in 21 is that those forgiven loans were not counted as income. And so we provided about a $450 million benefit to businesses by excluding that income. But I think you bring up a great point. I think as a legislature, and I was in the legislature at the time, we weren't, especially during COVID, we were providing those benefits, but not just, we didn't set up anything in that law, in that tax bill, to really have that accountability. And we know federally now it's a huge number that potentially is fraudulent.
Thank you very much. Members, we're going to move on to our next item. Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Ms. Leslie, for your testimony. And I appreciate your service.
Yeah, thank you very much, Madam Chair, members.
Thank you. I believe that Representative Norris is now with us. Representative Norris, I am going to move Senate File 856 be before the committee for jurisdiction, and I will move that bill be re-referred to Judiciary. I understand that there is an DE5 amendment. I will move the DE5 to be before the committee. And I'm going to request a roll call vote on that DE5. And I would ask you to please explain the DE5. Thank you. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Chair Cleavorn, and members of the committee for considering my bill today. I put a lot of work into this amendment to make the Office of the Inspector General as strong and effective as possible from day one. After months of hearing from experts, constituents, and legislators across the political spectrum. Fraud prevention isn't about politics. It's about making sure our programs work for Minnesotans. I'll walk you through every intentional and meticulous change I made to my bill and the reasons for each change. But first, I want to tell you why I do this work. I worked hard on this bill because, quite frankly, I'm furious about fraud. I'm furious about for-profit scammy businesses stealing from Minnesotans and our public services and programs. It's unacceptable. Every dollar lost to criminal fraud is a dollar that should have been going to feed, care for, and support vulnerable Minnesotans. These programs are absolutely essential for the people they serve. Public dollars should be going to help parents pay for childcare, people with disabilities get the support they need, and elders to age with dignity, not lie in the pockets of for-profit fraudsters. Together, we have to do everything we can this session to work this out. Greedy for-profit corporations have created a business model of fraud and made public programs their mark. We're determined to dismantle the business model of fraud and take action to prevent, detect, investigate, and punish the greedy fraudsters who drain our community resources. It's why we passed anti-fraud measures in 23 and 24, and again in 2025, as our understanding of the scope of the problem and the particular vulnerabilities of our programs evolved. It's also why the House DFL is proposing a robust anti-fraud package this session to address the root causes of the business model of fraud, with this bill included. And it's the reason I teamed up with Senator Gustafson to introduce this bill to create a statewide independent Office of the Inspector General last session. About the bill, there are several features that make this concept an effective tool against fraud. First is its independence. While constitutionally the governor must ultimately appoint the OIG, a bipartisan group of legislators, modeled after the Legislative Audit Commission, will vet potential candidates and forward recommendations, which will require support from both parties, to the governor. This fixes an issue with the initial bill, which likely would have gotten it stalled in court, when we need this office to start work immediately. Importantly, once appointed, the Inspector General can only be removed from office for cause, after a public hearing, and with the approval of 3/5 of the Senate, and thanks to this Delete Everything Amendment, or DE Amendment, 3/5 of the House. Second is its sweeping investigative powers. Under this DE, the OIG will have the authority to investigate any public or private entity that receives public funds to ensure compliance with applicable laws, conduct inspections, evaluations, and investigations of state executive branch agencies, issue subpoenas and refer matters for civil, criminal, or administrative actions to the BCA, and seek a court order or, where required by federal law, make a recommendation to the relevant commissioner to seek a court order, freezing or ceasing distributions of funds when fraud or credible allegation of fraud is uncovered. The third is its transparency. The OIG will be required to publish reports upon completion of an investigation summarizing its findings, recommendations, and outcomes of its activities. It'll have to submit an annual report summarizing its work to the legislature and the public. And it will have to report to the legislature regarding all investigations the OIG did not open after receiving a tip or complaint or decided to no longer actively pursue with an explanation of why. Minnesotans deserve an OIG with independence, transparency, and the sweeping investigative powers to get this essential work done. I want to commend my Republican colleague, Representative Patty Anderson, for bringing forward her own OIG proposal last year. It jump-started a very collaborative and bipartisan process by which members of all four legislative caucuses between the House and the Senate met weekly last year for hours at a time with a goal of merging our ideas and concepts. Those four caucus talks were incredibly beneficial and led to significant improvement of this bill. This amendment is built on that bipartisan foundation. It's based on countless conversations in the interim with legislators, the OLA, constituents, and other stakeholders to get the bill in the best possible form that is also constitutional so it can start eliminating fraud on day one. So let's walk through the main differences between the DE and the version that passed the Senate. First and most importantly, we have enhanced the powers and duties of the office to focus more on preventing fraud before it occurs, rather than simply investigating fraud after the fact. We know from existing cases that it is often very challenging to recover stolen funds after they're out the door. As a result, it is more cost-effective for us to prioritize preventing those dollars from fraudulently going out the door in the first place. If this office and our anti-fraud package becomes law, there will be less fraud requiring investigation. In that case, the OIG will have more power to proactively prevent situations that could lead to it. We also work closely with the Office of the Legislative Auditor to make sure the bill more clearly delineates between the duties of the OIG and the OLA. Second, this DE keeps the Department of Education Inspector General within MDE to ensure subject matter expertise and proximity to the programs being supervised. Otherwise, we create slower systems with more bureaucracy and less ability to be effective. There is a reason the federal government requires state agencies administering Medicaid and other benefits to keep the primary investigators in the agencies that administer the program. It's best practice. There is a benefit to having day-to-day working knowledge of the programs and systems for which you are ensuring program integrity, rather than just parachuting in when something goes wrong. Also, federal law is already requiring us to keep the DHS, DCYF, and Department of Health IGs within their agencies. So it only makes sense to do the same with the MDE. We codify the statewide OIG coordinating committee as well as part of this DE. This was established by executive order last fall. The executive branch reports that this is already proving to be a very useful tool for coordinating fraud response across state enterprise. So we felt it made sense to codify it into law. It breaks down silos to facilitate sharing of best practices and data in real time. As proposed in the DE, the centralized IG would chair the committee. Other members would include the commissioner or their designee of each agency that has its own inspector general, the BCA, the Office of Grants Management in the Department of Administration, and the Internal Controls and Accountability Unit in MMB. This committee would meet monthly to share investigative data, trends, and other information to better prevent, detect, and investigate fraud and misuse in agency programs. It would assist the Inspector General in the development of data sharing methods, investigative best practices, and program integrity review processes for agency programs. And it would assist agencies in securing specialized internal audit, investigation, or other necessary skills and tools. The addition of this committee would give the OIG more tools it needs to have the broad effect we intend across state government. The DE fourth removes the proposed OIG Anti-Fraud and Waste Bureau. This will avoid duplication of work the BCA's Financial Crimes Division already does. It will also avoid the fiscal inefficiencies that come with small law enforcement agencies. It just makes sense. While we're giving the OIG so many absolutely essential tasks to catch and prevent fraud across state government, why would we also task it with work other law enforcement is already doing? I have great confidence in the brave men and women of the BCA, and I hope this committee does too. Lastly, we fully fund the anticipated costs of establishing and running this agency to ensure this office has the necessary resources to do its job in a quality manner. The appropriation currently in the DE reflects the fiscal note from the Senate version of the bill. We anticipate the numbers are going to change a little bit based on some of the revisions in this DE. We've requested a revised fiscal note and intend to update the appropriation language at that time. But the current language is intended to reflect our commitment to fully funding this office, again, so they can be effective on day one. And last but certainly not least, it fixes some drafting oversights that slipped through in last year's end of session rush that would have rendered the bill unconstitutional. We believe these are common sense changes that strengthen the bipartisan foundation that passed the Senate, while still maintaining the key features of the office, like its independence, those sweeping investigative powers, and transparency. To be clear, a vote against this DE would be a vote against a focus on preventing fraud in the first place, rather than simply investigating it after the fact. Breaking down silos that prevent the sharing of best practices and real-time data, which would cause unnecessary headaches and more work for the Inspector General. Fully funding the work of preventing and fighting fraud. It won't work if we don't fund it, and much more. While we would love to pass the bill into law in the form of this DE, we're also realistic that there will likely be additional changes as this bill progresses through the process. I've learned in my time here in the legislature that bills become better and more effective with time and intentional conversations. And we need this bill to be as perfect as it can be to solve this most important problem. We welcome reaction to the DE and look forward to refining the language through continued four caucus talks and discussion with Representative Anderson once we've had an opportunity to publicly present our vision for a statewide OIG. I'm fully aware that this is going to take both Democratic and Republican votes for this idea to become law. And achieving that is going to require give and take on all sides to come to a solution that everybody can get behind. This proposed OIG is a powerful office meant to address a critical concern. But that power is the very reason why we must move in a thoughtful, diligent manner in crafting this legislation, rather than reflexively adopting language we received from the Senate. I ask that you all support my author's amendment, one that is a result of hours of work and collaboration. Minnesotans deserve a fully funded OIG that can fix this problem with all the tools they need to prevent, catch, and prosecute fraud on day one. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I have a couple of questions for Mr. Sullivan. Mr. Sullivan, if you would go to the testifiers table, I'd appreciate it. Thank you, Mr. Sullivan. Two questions that came to me that I would like for you to clarify as nonpartisan. I made the re-referral to judiciary. I believe that would be the next appropriate step. That's my opinion. Could you please explain to me if this bill would be required to go to judiciary?
Madam Chair and members, there is a House rule that requires bills that make substantial changes to data practices law to be referred to the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee prior to second reading. The rule that I'm referring to, I don't have the number with me right now, but I can find it when I'm back at my seat. It does, though, say the chair of the Judiciary Committee is ultimately the judge of which bills do not need to go to that committee, and will advise the speaker accordingly.
Thank you very much. And then the second question I have for you is about a DE amendment. It has been the custom for me as chair of this committee to allow an author to have their bill in the condition that they would like it in. But can you speak from a nonpartisan state, what do we train chairs to do about DE amendments?
Madam Chair and members, I work for the House Research Department. We do provide training for chairs of both caucuses. During the training, we typically do talk about author's amendments and customs for author's amendments in committees. But I do think it's important that the custom is based on, you know, my experience and that of my colleagues. And until last year, no one in my office had staffed a tied house or a committee with equal membership between the two caucuses. So we're sort of in uncharted territory a bit in terms of custom. But what I do say when I assist with the training for chairs is that it in my experience, is customary at the first committee stop for an author's amendment to be adopted so the author can get the bill in the shape that they prefer.
Okay. And then could you please tell me, because I have no history of this myself, when a Senate file is sent over, the Committee of Jurisdiction has to adopt that language. So this has stopped being a House file number and becomes a Senate file number. Do you have any recollection of a House author not being able to put their own DE on a House to adopt House language?
Madam Chair and members, you know, you're correct that when the Senate passes the companion to a House file and the House file is still in committee, the Senate companion is received by the House and referred to the committee, and then the committee sets aside the House file and works from the Senate file. Have I seen an instance in my time where the House author was not allowed to insert their own language into the Senate file? Not that I recall, but it's, you know, it's possible. I feel like I've, Ms. Roberts and I compared notes. We think we've seen it all one time or another, but I don't recall that particular scenario.
Thank you very much. And I would ask the CA to please, or the
Madam
CLA
Chair.
To please take
Madam
the
Chair,
role on the
DA. I would like to have a question
Chair
about
Cleaborn.
The amendment, Madam Chair.
Chair Cleaborn, aye.
Representative Nash?
Nash votes no.
Representative Bonner?
Yes.
Representative Bonner?
Yes.
Representative Davis?
No.
Representative Anderson?
Anderson, no.
Representative Clardy?
Aye.
Representative Freeburg?
Yes.
Representative Jones?
Yes.
Representative Joy?
No.
Representative Kosnick?
No.
Representative Kraft?
Aye.
Representative Nicolai?
Yes.
Representative Quam?
Your testifier did not bring up actual occurrences, which I remember
that
didn't follow that.
We are in a roll call vote.
Well,
please
that's because the chair would not allow questions.
Representative Quam?
Yet.
That's a no in another language.
Representative Sexton?
No.
Chairwoman, there are 7 ayes and 7 nays.
With 7 ayes and 7 nays, the motion does not prevail. The DE is not adopted.
Madam Chair, question of the chair.
Pardon?
Madam Chair, it is customary, we're going to be hung
Excuse
up on custom, to allow an amendment to receive questions. I had questions. I alerted you to the fact that I had questions and had comments.
No, I'm sorry, you did not.
Well, I most certainly did.
You did not.
I most certainly did. And I will point out to you that while custom says, and you and I talked about this yesterday, you said custom says that you should always allow for a DE or an author's amendment to go on. And I told you at the time that I had seen it happen before, and I was searching my memory, but what happened yesterday in the Health Committee was DFL members not allowing author's amendments to go on to GOP bills.
Excuse
so that
me,
happened
we are
yesterday.
Discussing this committee. We do not
so
discuss other committees.
The precedence
committee.
That you asked was of in the House. I provided an example for you. Moreover, the fact that we voted no against the DE was stakeholders are an important aspect of what we do here at the Capitol. Stakeholders are people on the inside and the outside of the Capitol, members of the Senate, members of the House. And I will remind you, Madam Chair, that I and my caucus are stakeholders. You didn't bring this bill to our attention. We only learned about the content of the DE when it posted, and that is a significant reason why we voted no, because we didn't have a chance to actually weigh in on it. In talking with members of the Senate who actually had crafted the Senate file themselves, they said that they had also not been consulted. So, and in Representative Norris's words, this is a wide sweeping, grandiose DE amendment, and we were not consulted.
I will address the committee as a whole, and then I will go to you, Representative Norris. The custom that I have set for bills is that we adopt the DE, and then we move to discussion. The DE was not adopted, therefore there is no discussion on the DE. It was not adopted by the committee. Therefore, basically, it doesn't exist. So for you, Representative Norris, I am sorry that we have brought you here early in the morning, only to have the work of the House ignored and left unadopted. I apologize to you. I have never seen that in this committee. The other thing is I would like to thank you for the incredible work that you did over the interim, including the Senate author. And I have spoken to the Senate author myself, who does not disagree with this process, because where there are disagreements, there is growth. And so to have two bills that are not exactly the same brings us growth and better policy and better procedure. It is unfortunate that my colleagues did not agree to allow discussion on this bill by denying you your DE amendment. And with that, members, the work of this committee is, oh, I'll let you speak and then I will adjourn. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Clevorn. You know, like I said, you know, we should be putting people over politics here. You know, we need the OIG to be as strong and effective as possible on day one. And every change I made served that mission. I am happy to continue conversations with any member of this committee, and I hope I can earn your vote in a future hearing. Fraud prevention should not be about politics or parties. It should be about excellent and well-thought-out government practices. I truly hope we can schedule this bill for another hearing sometime soon so that we can pass the version that I believe will best achieve the vision and outcomes we have for Minnesota. So thank you, Chair Clevorn.
And before I close, I will say this. To my co-chair, Chair Nash, I have followed the same procedure I have always followed about accepting a DE and then discussion of the DE. When our committee members are going to work, we have to work collaboratively. We have to work together. You and I have always had an open conversation about the work that we do, and I respect that, and I appreciate the work that we have been able to do together in confidence. But in this particular issue, I feel as though I am negotiating and having a co-chair who is not present fully in this room, not you, Chair Nash, I'm not discussing you, but there is another co-chair to this committee who is not in this room. And with that, members, we are adjourned.